Welcome to Saltgrass, a show about how local communities can engage with the climate crisis at a grassroots level. My name is Ali Hanley. This is the second episode of three I'm doing about housing solutions in my local community. I recommend that you go back and listen to the first episode if you haven't already. If you're listening from a podcast app, you know what to do. If you're listening on the radio, you can listen to the first episode at saltgrasspodcast.com or on your preferred podcasting app. In summary, though, in the last episode, we heard how housing density and housing justice are both critical climate responses. We unpacked all of the various reasons why different people might find housing security elusive. We looked at who are at risk of housing insecurity in my local community and some of the organisations that are trying to help. We also heard how there are a lot of much bigger societal and systemic problems that need to be ironed out. So I think it's time to start looking at some solutions. In this episode, I will introduce you to the two researchers from RMIT University who have instigated all of this discussion, and we will delve into what deliberative development and co-housing can look like, and why it might just be a good way forward for some people in the housing crisis. Then in the next episode, we'll hear about some other creative responses proposed for this community and by this community to meet our housing needs. As ever, I want to acknowledge that Saltgrass is produced on Jarra Country, the home of the Jajawurrung. They have been zero waste ecosystem guardians and custodians of this land for countless generations and continue to lead the way and generously share their wisdom on how to live here better. I give thanks to them and honour Jandak, the country itself, and the Jarra elders past and present. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Salt of the earth.
Salt.
Grassroots.
Salt of the earth people. Grassroots change. Saltgrass.
Listen to all episodes of Saltgrass on your podcast app or at saltgrasspodcast.com. So let's start by meeting Andrea Sharam and Jen Lynch, the RMIT University researchers who initiated this conversation about housing. We met out at Vaughan Springs, which is a lovely swimming hole near town. It was a beautiful, clear morning, and you'll hear the birds in the background. By the time of this interview, we had been working together for about 6 months, and they had visited a couple of times, and once was to have a little tour of all of the deliberative development, co-housing, or similar type of sites that already exist in Castlemaine. They may not have been called deliberative development when they were built, and some of them were built up to 20 years ago, but they share a lot of the principles. So it was interesting to see what some of those developments look like two decades later. It's been a funny kind of crash course for me talking to Andrea and Jen over the last 6 months, trying to get my head around all of the terminology and concepts of deliberative development and co-housing. And I'm still not sure I have it all straight, but how lucky am I to have had two university lecturers to graciously guide me through it and invite me to sit in for all of the conversations and help me get to know my own town better through this lens of housing security.
I'm Andrea Sharam and I'm a senior lecturer in the School of Property, Construction and Project Management at RMIT University. I'm a housing researcher, yeah. And I'm particularly interested in affordable housing and market models of affordable housing.
I'm not sure if I know what that means.
Well, that's a good question to ask.
I often try and listen and I'm like, okay, I don't want to sound dumb, but also I don't want my audience to feel dumb for not knowing what things mean.
Yeah.
And so I might as well ask the dumb question.
Exactly. We're always like one of those people in a class, actually.
Yeah.
So what I mean by affordable market housing is, so it's not going to be social housing. There won't be any kind of subsidy. Subsidies usually come from government to assist people. So really what I'm interested in, how can models that are purely market with no subsidy develop in Australia to service people who are struggling with the high housing prices? How can we get affordable housing for ordinary people on moderate incomes?
I'm Jen Lynch. I'm a landscape architect and a lecturer in the School of Architecture and Urban Design at RMIT. And the research interest that exists in this project for me sort of related to my interest in the commons in my work. And commons are sites or spaces that are collectively managed as a resource rather than owned by one individual or party. So they tend to lead to different values, different dynamics, different sensitivities, different processes behind them. So I'm really interested in spaces that start to operate as commons and how designers can start to shift people's understandings of the spaces that they live with in their everyday lives and support those types of commoning processes to take off.
Providing people the opportunity to obtain housing that's developed in a collective way. So we're talking about multi-residential housing rather than individual houses. The need for more housing within urban centres, town centres, to provide diversity of housing for people's needs. And just the cost constraints, people have to reduce the housing consumption that they have. So it leads to multi-residential development. As individuals, there's very few individuals who have the kind of wealth necessary to go develop a block of flats. So the market has always done it. There's always been a developer, and they're always a speculative developer who's seeking to profit by that. So what we're about is, what if groups of people who want a new home for themselves and for their friends get together with their friends and become the developer? So they develop it themselves. So they get the housing at cost, and then they also get the housing that they want within the financial constraints. So if you want lots of sustainability and you can afford it, that's what you have. If you want a common music room, for example, or a common guest room, you can have those things. These are all the things you won't get out of a speculative developer. If you have a group of people who come together to act collectively as the developer, there are a range of models people can choose. So the first decision is, what kind of model do you want? Is it just about creating housing, or are you also trying to create some community? And there's many models on this spectrum.
These other ownership arrangements became of interest to me because they legally capture some of these other ways of relating to home ownership or to a community you might share a home to some degree with. There's a really specific form of housing crisis that we understand to characterize regional Victoria, and some of the things are an aging population that can't downsize, or younger people who do have income but aren't able to enter into the property market. So there's really specific puzzle pieces that could potentially start to be pooled. I guess it goes back to this idea of the commons. It's like there's actually these pieces that independently people aren't actually able to access the things that they need, but that sort of power and collectivizing and bringing resources that are individually held together could potentially unlock opportunities for groups if they did form and decide that they wanted to undertake one of these types of development together. So that was really the scope of this research. That was the interest in Castlemaine, identifying that potential was there, especially in a community like Castlemaine where there's already a lot of engagement, already a really highly connected community, already some really progressive work happening, an active discussion around housing. Everything's sort of there.
So the commoning here is that you have individuals that hold resources for a collective multi-unit development. We call it deliberative development when a group of people come together to deliberately build something, a non-speculative, you know, development. So lots of people have bits of the puzzle. Some people have equity in the form of existing housing or land. Other people are actually industry pressures, you know, whether they're architects or planners, or even if they work for a developer, for example, they have skills that they can bring because knowledge is really powerful in this process. And some people have savings. Some people have quite good incomes, but they have no savings. As we know, it's quite difficult to save for a deposit because the housing prices are so high. So people have these different resources they could bring. They individually can't get what they need, but actually if they come together as a group, all the puzzle pieces could come together and they could have a project. Now, very commonly what people do is they come together, they form a company or a joint venture, and they develop the housing and it becomes strata title and everyone owns their own property, and then there is no future relationship between you except as an owner's corporation. So that's at one end of the spectrum. So basically you've developed your own housing, you've got it at cost, but you can go all the way through to the other end of the spectrum and become co-housing or a co-op. You can form intentional communities where you are very deliberately setting out to share common property. In all these models, people are taking ownership of the dwelling, that the owner's corporation has a lot more assets in there than just the leftover garden bit that the town planning required them to have. And that they'll have everything, things from having a separate bathroom so you don't have to have that in your own apartment, for example, or a common garden or a common dining room. You can have all those things. But you can also have how you're going to live. Like, you can actually come to agreements about how you are all going to collectively live. But the property titles are separate to those agreements, so they can have a relationship, but it depends what people want to have. So that's a key choice you have to have at the beginning of the process. So succession, when people want to leave, in most cases it's strata title and they own, so you can just sell and leave. The barest model, the rest of the people have absolutely no say in it whatsoever. But if you're in a co-housing or cooperative, there might be. But only might, not always. Urban Coop, for example, in Melbourne, it's what they call an open co-housing model. So people sell, they just leave, and new people come in, and everyone kind of hopes that they really want to be into co-housing.
The night before we had this conversation was the presentation and workshop event that Jen and Andrea had organised, which was really the culmination of our 6 months of working together. They had invited deliberative development experts to come and speak to the local community. And then they had attendees break out into groups and workshop what different people might be able to bring to the table if they were to consider the potential of deliberative developments or co-housing locally. The first speaker of the night was Tim Riley, the founder and development director of Property Collectives, an advisory service that supports resident groups to co-develop multi-residential housing. After him, we heard from Jasmine Palmer, a housing researcher who is also a member of Urban Coop, which is a 29-household co-housing apartment project in Brunswick. Both of these presenters were from Melbourne and shared their experience of deliberative development projects that have been built, so it was great to hear those success stories. And then the third presentation that night was from a local group, WINC, which is Older Women in Co-Housing. And this is a deliberative development and co-housing project proposed for Castlemaine. The two women who presented for WINC on the night were Mary Faith Chenery and Aniki Deutsch. They are both founding members of the group. WINC is still in the early stages. They have purchased land, but they have not started construction. Because it's a local project, I took the opportunity of sitting down for a longer conversation with them a couple of weeks later, which I'll share with you after we hear from Tim and Jasmine. These three presenters were invited to share their stories to support local people in understanding what deliberative development is and different formats that it can take, and also to explore how it might work locally. So first up, let's hear from Tim Riley and then Jasmine Palmer.
So my name's Tim Riley and I started Property Collectives in 2010. It was four townhouses in North Melbourne. I just teamed up with my friend who's an architect. We thought we could do something like this and we ended up finishing it, which was good, with a couple of our other friends from uni days, and I'll explain a bit more about the model in a second. So we are developers and advisors, and we like to focus our time and our money on projects that we think are purposeful and have impact. There's a couple of parts to what we do. We provide advisory services, and we've been providing advice to local councils, state government, affordable housing groups like Mary Beck of Affordable Housing, industry associations like CHIA, the peak body for the community housing organisations in Victoria, religious organisations, affordable housing providers and some long-term asset managers. But the big thing that we've been doing since 2010 is creating this model around building groups. We call it building groups. We've established 10 different collectives building 80 homes across Melbourne since 2010. And they've mostly been inner Melbourne, small infield sites. Most of them have been around 6 to 8 dwellings, but our largest project at the moment is in Eltham, and that's 21 homes, a co-housing project in Eltham. So all up, it's nearly about $100 million worth of property, and for the members in these collectives, we've delivered or we're forecasting to deliver around $9 million of savings to the members of these collectives, because it's a co-development model. So we're helping these groups come together and then co-develop the housing outcome that they want and then delivering them their homes at cost. So I suppose the key difference with this model is that it's not speculative, it's deliberative. We spend a lot of time up front with a core group trying to work out what their vision is, and then we help them put together a finance strategy and a property strategy, and then we go out and help them acquire a piece of land that works for them and their specific needs, and then we help them through the whole development process. Allowing people to purchase land and take a fractional ownership of a property, like a single title, and then through the process create direct home ownership at cost through that subdivision process. And the key to the model really is that the members are controlling the equity that's going into the project. Like, if you can control the equity, you can control the outcome. Like, if you have a vision, obviously there's lots of nuts and bolts through the development process to negotiate, but that's kind of what we're here to do for groups in terms of giving them that nuts and bolts technical support through the process. But at its core, these groups, they're able to control the outcome because they're controlling the equity. So today I'm talking about the Victoria Street Collective. So the Victoria Street Collective is a group of 10 owners who've come together to build 10 apartments in West Brunswick. So it's a mixed community. There's downsizers, first home buyers, upgrades, and this group was really keen to create an intergenerational community. There's a couple of family groups and a couple of sort of friendship circles that have all come together for this project. So we bought this block of land in 2018. It's right next to the Westwick Eco Village, and we're going to finish this project in February 2024. We did purchase one lot, and then we purchased the neighbouring block, which took about a year to do, and that's held things up during the design process. We originally thought it would be 6 dwellings, but we expanded it to 10 with the purchase of the neighbouring block. Now, the brief from this group was that they wanted high-performance buildings with communal features to enhance social interaction. So despite the scale being 10 dwellings, it was very much a co-housing, intentional community kind of intention. The goal was net zero operations. So from a design perspective, it was about designing them with passive house features, but the group, they didn't need the certification. You know, they just wanted really high-performing buildings, but didn't necessarily need the passive house. And the other part of the brief was they really wanted to keep this magnificent silky oak. So we appointed Zen Architects, who had good experience in delivering high-performing single homes, but not much multi-residential experience. But the group was comfortable with that, given that they delivered a lot of high-performing homes. And we bought this land for $2.55 million for a bit under 1,200 square metres. So ground floor plan, you can kind of see here. The key to this was to get as many buildings north-facing as possible. So we've created two buildings, and in the middle, communal courtyard, which everybody shares. So the orientation and siting really has been key. In terms of performance, we've achieved an average 8.7 NATHERS rating. We've got the highest performing homes at 9.2. We were lucky with council as well. They gave us dispensation on secluded private open space in acknowledgement for the fact that we were providing this big, generous communal courtyard, which was good. Construction wise, we've made this out of blockwork walls and concrete slab for the thermal performance. We've also got 32 kilowatt Alum SolShare solar PV system. We've got our solar hot water from Earthworker Co-op, and we've got heat recovery systems. So I think the thing to note here is this project wouldn't have been delivered by this speculative market. It's not affordable, but the vision, we're realising the vision of this group of people.
Hi, I'm Jasmine Palmer. I'm speaking today as resident of a co-housing project. So I'm actually a collaborative housing researcher and used to be an architect and worked together with some co-housing groups on different projects around the place. But I'm speaking today as a resident of the Urban Coop co-housing development that we moved into June last year. And this is located in Brunswick. So we're a self-formed co-housing group, and we team together with professionals to deliver our project, and I'll go into that a little bit more. We're 29 apartments ranging from 53 to 105 square metres, so from one bedroom plus study at 53 square metres up to four bedrooms at 104. We've already got 52 residents, and we're strata titled. We were due to move in 2021, but we had lots of issues and hiccups in that sort of 2020 period we don't mention, and we didn't move in until a year after expected. We're a diverse demographic. We're not a specific group. We're open to anyone who wants to come in and be a part of the community. In most apartment developments in our area at the moment, they stop at two bedrooms. There's nothing other than that. So the three bedrooms and four bedrooms were really important for us for getting families into the development. The group first formed in 2008. I first became involved with the group in 2012 and started doing my PhD on them in 2013, on them and Tim's first project and a few others around Melbourne and a few others around the UK and Germany, and then joined afterwards. So I didn't actually become a member of the group until 2016. And fortunately, that's when things started happening, not due to me joining, but due to things just happening to coincide at that point. That's when we made agreements with professionals, secured land, went into construction, and eventually moved in. But I think we're going to sort of mention a few times that first sort of 8 years, which were really important years for us for building a community and learning how to work together and make decisions. Demographics, where half of us are single, almost half are single households, 34% are couples without resident children, 14% are households with children, a third, nearly a third, are over 65, and just over 10% are households who have members with really quite high special needs. We're actually located in what's known as the Nightingale Village in Brunswick, so there's six buildings altogether, and we're one of those. But we like to remind ourselves continuously that we're different to all the others. And it's because of that 8 years before entering into the contracts that we are different to all the others and have a very different foundation to work from. More than 15% of the interior space within the building is shared spaces. That includes a 150 square metre kitchen and dining area, a 60 square metre area for guest accommodation, so that you might not have a guest room in your house, but you can book out the one. Another 60 square metres of a multi-purpose room. But I'm not really focused on sort of showing the spaces today. It's more the idea. It's more about the people that live in the building. If we Google us at the moment, there's lots and lots of really fancy architecture images out there presenting us, because last week we won 3 more National Architecture Awards. The months before that, we run piles of Victorian Architecture Awards. And at the moment, if you Google us, you get all these fancy images. Images of people walking down our stairs who aren't us, but are dressed by the photographer in a nicely coloured dress to match the fittings of the building. And this one of our dining room, where they've even removed all our books off the shelf to make it look as neat and tidy as possible. All they left in there was one plant. What I didn't mention, we also have is a communal laundry, communal drying areas on the roof. Often apartments don't have areas for external drying, so we don't have to use clothes dryers, or we don't have any clothes dryers. We also have bike parking in the basement for about 90 bikes. And we also have a music room down there, which we actually call the sound space. If you do any activity, it doesn't have to be practicing music, any activity that makes a lot of sound, go do it down there in the sound space. And we also have a tool workshop down there as well. So the things that people often say, oh, I couldn't live in an apartment because I like to fiddle about and do things in my shed. We've got the shed. We share it. And one interesting thing about our designs that we share, unlike many apartment buildings, our balconies are all interlinked. There's 2 or 3 apartments and they each have sort of an allocated amount of balcony. But they're built in such a way that they're automatically connected, but you can choose to separate them. And some people have. They've gone, I've got a dog, I'm going to separate it, or I don't really like my neighbour that much, I'm going to put something there. But just this idea that there's that flexibility of connection through the external spaces as well. I think the really special thing about our building design is that we wrote the brief before we had anything to do with architects. So the community wrote the brief. After many attempts to enter into development agreements with community housing partners, with other developers, with not-for-profit developers and all sorts of things, we ended up partnering with Nightingale, hence ending up in the Nightingale Village. So what did that mean? It meant that we partnered with them before there was land. Each household in our project put in $60,000 before we knew where we were going to live. We didn't have land. We put the faith in. People had been working together for 8 years and said, you know, this is not about me picking my perfect building for the rest of my life. This is about me living with these other people. So if we all put some skin in the game, we'll get somewhere. Because for the 8 years before that, we didn't put enough skin in the game. So we put in $60,000 each. So collective, we could lend $1.8 million to the developer for them to leverage finance and to know that they had sales. So they could go out and buy land, find land that would suit us, and then once we agreed on that land, they got our money and knew that we were committed. That gave us the right to buy the pre-sale contracts. So I put in my 60 grand. If they'd found land that I didn't like in a place I didn't want to move to, then I simply wouldn't have signed the pre-sale contract. But I wouldn't get my 60 grand back till the project was finished, but I would get it back. So, you know, it was an interesting process, but it did end up with sort of purchasing off the plan. It was COVID. Prices went up. We ran out of money. We stripped out so much stuff out of the building. So I think one thing about these kinds of projects is being prepared to say, okay, we've got our multipurpose room. We know this is going to be a great space in the future, but at the moment it's literally a concrete shell. It's just a lock-up space that we put some coloured carpet tiles on the floor. There's no lighting in there, there's no electrics. We've got to come in and finish it, and they're things that we're working on. And I actually think these types of projects can get a lot of value from not being finished, because we've been living in it for a year, and now we're working together to decide on the final design for those spaces, including the outside spaces that weren't finished either. So these are quite recent workshops where we're still working together to figure out how we want to live. How do we make those decisions? Up until we moved in, we were using a modified consensus system, and we've recently switched to this sort of sociocracy or consent type decision making. In terms of sharing, I think the important things for us is that we're not just sharing space. So this is not just about the architectural space, it's about the things we share. It's about the food that we grow collectively and share and eat together. It's about the fact that on my floor, we've got one vacuum cleaner for four apartments. We don't need one each. We just put it in the hallway in the cupboard and share it, you know. So there's all sorts of things that we share, but it's also about the actions. So in that room that's unfinished, it's still already got enormous amounts of use. There's yoga in there at 6:30 every morning. There's craft groups on Sundays. There's meditation on Fridays. It's the things we do together that make the spaces work, not the spaces themselves.
So as mentioned earlier, the third presentation of the night was from WINC, Older Women in Co-Housing. And instead of sharing what Mary Faith and Aniki said on the night, I took advantage of the fact that it was a local project and I sat in on an info session they were running for prospective members several weeks later. I got to hear about the plans and the scope of the project, and I also heard questions from people interested in buying in, which was really interesting to hear. There was a lovely morning tea provided, and once most of the people had left, we had the space to sit down and have a chat about what WINC is and how it started. In terms of the need for housing, you've focused specifically on older women. Do you feel like it's a group that needs particular care or support in terms of having secure housing in old age?
The fastest growing group of homeless people are women over the age of 55. And it's largely because the gendered nature of poverty, time out of the workforce, you know, the gender pay gap, low superannuation. So typically if there's a relationship breakdown, a woman might end up with half the value of a house, and then you get to age 60, 65, you can't borrow because you don't have the working years left to pay off a loan.
So the banks won't support you in getting a mortgage if you've only got half a house worth of income.
That's right. We realised, I guess, from our own friends and contacts that there's a range of reasons that women face homelessness, and they often don't realise it. They might have had very well-paying jobs and might have rented their whole lives, and then all it takes is one notice to vacate or a health crisis where they can't work and they can't pay rent, and suddenly they go from being in a pretty comfortable job, nice house, to not having anywhere to live. So that's why we realised that we needed WINC to cater for women with a whole lot of different financial situations, whether they be social housing eligible or able to buy outright or able to get a mortgage or not.
Well, one of the things that I appreciated about this idea as it evolved is that you don't choose your friends by how much money they have. And as COVID happened and as we learned more about the housing crisis, we saw so many women just finding themselves in their cars. Mm. And that just seemed ridiculous. So then the idea of putting this all together and making space for and dedicating a commitment to space for social housing for middle women and for full owners made a lot of sense. Mm.
I was curious about what they meant by middle women, and they explained to me that it's the women who have some assets or some capital, but maybe not enough to buy one of the units outright.
She might have 40% of the house, or she might own 60%, depends what she's got, and the unit trust could own the rest. And then when it's sold, the unit trust distributes to its investors and she gets her percentage back. We've raised so far about $60,000 for that. We haven't put a lot of effort into it. It's going to need at least $700,000 if it's going to buy all the gaps in the homes that the middle women have.
WINC would have shared equity in their house and would just turn that back over into another middle woman's home when she leaves. So we want that money to be in perpetuity available for middle women.
Yeah, so any donations would go for that purpose. And we expect, as women who are part of WINC, die and some women don't have dependents or think this is a good cause may well leave their properties to Wink. And so we think over time that the amount of shares in housing or wealth that Wink itself builds up will enable it to, in perpetuity, the next middlewoman to buy in at whatever the costs are then.
That's great, I love that.
So there's some women who need Wink not because they can't afford anything else, like we've talked about social housing middlewomen, but then two-thirds of the group are women who need it because of the support and way it provides connectivity and stops isolation.
We just want to live here.
And they are typically women in large houses. They might have raised their kids. Well, they might have a 3 or 4 bedroom house with living by themselves. Partner might have died. And some have accumulated wealth unintentionally just through buying a house when they could afford to do it in the 70s or 80s and when it wasn't 10 times an annual salary to buy a house. And so they have the funds.
Yeah. And we need to find ways that respect what they want to downsize, not into something that's not suitable and doesn't have a country feel, but something that they can use.
And that's accessible and that's, you know, energy efficient and thermally efficient and built well. And then we looked at various legal structures to say, well, how can we support all those varieties of tenure? And could it be a co-op? Could it be some sort of retirement village structure? Could it be a company that owns the land? So we looked at all sorts of options, but the best that gave women an option to get a mortgage if they could, for women who wanted to buy in, to have the security of title that they could sell if they wanted to, and for housing providers to be able to buy in, was common garden variety, freehold title and an owner's corporation.
We have three key ideas that have guided us. One is sustainability in housing and accessibility to make sure that everyone can get to and from everything, and to design in such a way that people will run into each other in a casual sort of way so that community is built and fostered.
Through incidental interactions.
Yeah, so you're not forcing it. You're not crowbarring community.
No.
You've designed it so that it will happen organically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it means sharing things. That's a way that you create community, because if you need to go out of your house to do your washing at the shared laundry, then while you're waiting for your washing or on the way to do your washing or on the way to hang it out, you will meet people, have chats.
And then somebody says, I'm thinking of going to a movie tonight. Do you want to go? And so you run into that kind of thing. And whereas I might be a fairly shy person who doesn't normally initiate things, I can get dragged in a way that's good for me.
Mm.
Yeah.
Car parking is intentionally put away from the houses, and that's so that you have safe pedestrian areas with no cars, but also so that you do actually have to travel either on foot or, if you can't walk, on electric scooter or mobility scooter or something. And in doing so, again, you meet people along the way. At least half our members want to be part of a carpooling group. So because of town planning regulations, we've put a car parking for every dwelling. We don't expect them all to be used ultimately. And we expect there to be shared cars for those who either want to just share a car with one other person, like I do with Mary Faith at the moment, or those who might want to be part of a carpooling group that might have 5 or 6 cars in it. And then depending if you need a van or a ute or a really efficient electric sedan, you choose the one you need depending on what your journey is.
I envision some shared exercise equipment that fit into the landscape as well as what's in the common house, in an area of the common house where we can exercise indoors.
Yeah, okay. Sort of like those outdoor gyms that are at some of the parks.
And yeah.
I love that.
But hopefully slightly more subtle.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, they're great, but, but you know, I think we want them. And we were talking about it just recently and talking about you might have 2 of them in an area on a walking path so that if somebody is there just doing gentle push-ups, that somebody else who comes along can join and they can talk in an out-of-breath manner.
I find exercising with someone else is much more motivating than doing it on your own. So coming back to your basic principles, you said sustainability was one of them. How does that happen in a building cooperative like this?
Well, we're fairly committed to it. We're not registering for passive house design, but we're aiming for passive house level buildings. So very well insulated buildings, north-facing glass, double glazed, with heat recovery ventilation systems, so you get fresh air in all the time, even if it's smoky or high pollen count days, and that cost very minimal to heat or cool.
Yeah, so it makes the most of the winter sun and then protects you from the summer sun.
Yeah.
And you were saying earlier maybe solar panels?
Yes, every building's going to have about a 6 kilowatt system, which should be plenty to run buildings that don't have very high energy use. But we also plan to use that power for what will be increasingly more electric cars. We settled on this land in March last year, and in January, which is, well, 10 months after that, we applied for town planning, and we're
so
waiting.
So just like a couple of weeks ago, you applied for town planning.
Yeah, 15th of January.
No, exactly 36 days or something.
Yeah, you've been counting.
Yeah. Well, they officially have 60 days.
Yeah.
But we expect it will take longer. So we're waiting for town planning approval, and we're in the process of early negotiations with the local developer builder who's costing the houses, and then we'll know the final costs once we know that what the conditions are for town planning, because that can add a lot to the cost depending what civil works are required. And in the meantime, we'll be continuing to have our meetings and have events where we continue to build the community and make decisions as a group about all sorts of things. What's on the agenda for tomorrow?
In the agenda for the meeting, there are things about refund, about making a decision on the builder, about...
Yeah. Is everyone happy for us to sign a heads of agreement with this builder?
Yep. So we met with him the other night online. There are decisions commitment fee, about encouraging participation and keeping records of that so that you can sort of own up to it. Mm-hmm. We have a discussion about what is the definition of a middlewoman.
And what's the eligibility criteria to be one?
Yep, yep. Just the stock standard build a community stuff.
Yeah, the nitty gritty of it all.
Mm.
And how many people have you got?
We have 41 members now. We have 5 currently exploring WINC. Ideally, we're planning for a waiting list of 30 members, roughly. Some social, some middle women, some full owner potential, so that when houses become available for sale, we can say to the group, there's a 50 square metre house.
Who wants it?
Yeah.
And then the member who's got the lower member number, who's been a member longest. Yeah, and we've currently got 28 houses allocated to members, including all the social housing, except for one. And we've got one middle woman house available and one 80 square metre, two-bedroom house available. But we think after we're requiring those who have their name on a house to actually pay a $5,000 commitment fee on the 1st of March, which will form basically like a holding deposit or part of their deposit when they sign a contract of sale to buy off the plan. And we think at that point there'll be some who, if they've been hanging in there but they're not really sure that they're ready to buy in the first tranche, that they might drop out.
Or revert back to the end of the waiting list or something.
Yeah.
Well, just to revert into a non-buying. Yeah, they keep their member number.
Yeah, great.
But
they might not be ready.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Well, people's health changes and...
Life changes.
Yeah.
That's all reasons. And so then the finished building date is hopefully 2026 to move in?
Probably mid-26, if all goes well. but everything will need to be bought off the plan probably 15 or 18 months before that.
Yeah, so people are making a big commitment before they've got anything to move into.
Yeah.
And we need our 10% deposit or whatever it is to be ready for that. But then there'll be lots of people coming up here watching the build come out of the ground, and it'll be very exciting.
I think so.
Mm.
Yeah.
We do hope that this is a model for others, and we're happy to share what we've learned and what we've used and the procedures we've developed and all that stuff so that somebody else can do it nearby or afar, because I really think that co-housing is a terrific form of community building and shared living.
So WINC is really interesting because it's right on the cusp of being actualised, and this is of course quite a risky moment when people who have been saying that they'll put money in may not, but all goes according to plan, they'll get their permits from council and their investors will commit and building will start soon. And once it's been built, I think it will be much easier for them to find people to buy in and keep the ball rolling. So if we head back to the night of the workshop, the room had been really full, and from where I sat at the back, plugged into the sound system, it seemed really successful. But the next morning when I sat with Jen and Andrea out at Vaughan Springs, I asked them what they thought of the event, and especially the second half, the workshop component, which is where people were sharing ideas. What was your sense of how people were
amazing.
Ready? Yeah. There was an energy level in the room.
Absolutely amazing. Like, people, they heard the presentations of how other people had done it, and they went straight into their little groups, and they got down to business.
Yeah. They were ready.
The hunger, so palpable in the room, and people absolutely want to have a follow-up on that, and we're definitely discussing what we can provide outside the scope of, you know, the current research project. But personally, I've got a long-term commitment to this. It's kind of my activism, so we will definitely be having conversation of what resources we can bring to these groups. And for me, that's about what is development. Development 101, development finance 101, they're critical knowledge sets that groups need to have. So I'll be keen to try and get some kind of training for that to happen. That's in a context of, all right, so you think you have a group that might be forming. There's a lot more around the visioning, and then there's the moment where people sit down together, and this is what we did last night on a kind of very preliminary basis. A group sits down together and they have to have a very serious conversation about what each party will bring to it. Like, how much money have you got? That question has...
All those impolite questions that you would never...
Yeah, and this is a challenge for, you know, our culture, where we don't talk about money, but the money conversation must happen up front. People need to be brutally honest about what they can contribute. Everyone needs to understand the risks that are involved. One of the risks that are involved in doing this, of course, is when costs during construction start to escalate beyond what people thought they were going to have to put in. In the current era, everything's going up in terms of construction, and there's delays. So in the current era, you have to have a big contingency factor. So if you bought a speculative apartment, you're protected from that. There's different professionals for different parts of it. So that thing about forming a group and what your values are, I think there's people who can facilitate those conversations. And again, it depends on what you're actually aspiring to. If all you're wanting to do is get the housing out of it and have your strata title and you don't necessarily want to talk to anyone else ever again, that's much simpler. But there still needs to be a vision and aspirations, and all that still needs to be worked out. But there is a need for speed, because you need everyone on the same page at the same time to make the commitment at the same time. Once you're at that point, you want everything to move as fast as you can.
To me, the biggest step, or the most dramatic step in which Asma presented, was actually that moment where everybody contributed $60,000. It was such a big commitment, because I'm like, that to me feels like it would have been the most challenging thing to do, because like you said, everybody has to be in alignment. There's such an instinct that's maybe culturally built in around the way we relate to home, which is, I want this kind of security, I want this dream, I want this fantasy. And so it's like, I guess getting everybody lined up on that same page where they're willing to coordinate and co-commit is like, to me, that seemed like it would have been a really big challenge. That to me is the most unimaginable part, is that big shift in understanding and that sort of buy-in and commitment. Yeah. Because like you said, then all of a sudden things shift out of alignment very quickly, like within a year, within 3 years, it's...
Yeah, life happens.
Yeah.
Sure does.
That's a key risk in this model. But the model can deliver so much for people that for some people, it's absolutely worth the commitment and the risks of going through with it. Yeah. And for a regional centre where the lack of housing diversity is quite problematic, this is a way of getting that kind of diversity. There is a need for smaller units that are accessible, for example, so that, you know, there would be very little fully accessible accommodation here. So it's the opportunity to create the housing that's actually needed.
I guess being part of a commons, I think that people know how to be with each other. There's things that happen, decisions get made collectively and resources get pooled, and there's this active co-creation in an ongoing sense of the space.
that shared, but I guess the difference with this is that the risks are so much higher and what people are investing in them is so much more significant and the time frames are longer term.
And contractually...
Totally, yes.
Have to commit.
Yeah. So you have to figure out how to translate these things that might occur in a lower stakes environment quite organically. I think that process of formalizing them is probably the big challenge.
Yeah, the visioning process is the fun part of this process. You know, you get together and you talk about what you could have. It's such an exciting thing to do. But ideally, we would like people to be able to access resources very early on so that they have the parameters around that visioning process. It's about matching the vision and the aspiration to the pragmatism. So trying to bring those two things together to reduce all the risks, and hopefully as it becomes a more common form of housing that everyone gets familiar and it works faster and faster and we reduce all the risks so that it becomes a significant part of the housing supply as it is in Germany, for example. That's why we want to bring people who have done it to bring their knowledge to others, and we will continue to try and capture that knowledge for people to use.
So obviously deliberative development and co-housing will not be for everyone. Some people would run a mile at the idea of all of the meetings and negotiations that would have to take place to make a deliberative development project happen, let alone the ongoing interaction required for a successful co-housing community to be a part of that equation. And to others, it may sound like the perfect combination of creative input and financial advantage. Some people may love the idea of the level of community co-housing involved, and others will just want to build a home. And of course, many wouldn't be able to buy into a project, even if it is reduced in cost compared to similar projects created by commercial developers. Not to mention the fact that, as you've heard, deliberative development can take years to make it happen. So in the next episode, we're going to be looking at some of the ideas, projects, and possibilities that the local community is investigating. Some of them are quite similar to deliberative development in terms of the need they're serving in the community of constructing smaller dwellings that are accessible and safe and more affordable. And others are creative solutions that will hopefully help people get homed more quickly. So stay tuned for that. If any part of the conversation today caught your attention, there are links and notes about the show on the episode page on the Saltgrass website. Don't forget to get your Saltgrass Ethical t-shirts from the merch shop. There are new designs all the time. For those of you listening on the radio, please note that you can listen to all episodes of Saltgrass, including the two episodes around housing on either side of this episode, on your preferred podcasting app or at saltgrasspodcast.com. You can follow us on all the socials and you can subscribe to our email list to get reminders and updates about the show. This program was made possible with support from Main FM and the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. These three episodes and the research of Jen and Andrea was supported by RMIT University's Strategic Impact Fund, which supports interdisciplinary research translation through projects that bring together RMIT researchers, industry and community. My name is Ellie Hanley. Thanks for listening.
Salt.
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 Grassroots.
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 Salt of the earth people. Grassroots change.
Saltgrass.
Listen to all episodes of Saltgrass on your podcast app or at saltgrasspodcast.com.